Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte City Council spends a lot of time during their Raleigh retreat grappling with funding issues for major projects. Warning, the General Assembly is back in session. Among Democrats' top priorities, Medicare expansion. This was the week a new elections board was to come into being with an eye toward solving the 9th District problem. A wrench thrown into the works, but we're over that little speed hump. And homicides in Charlotte are already running high just 1 month into 2019. CMS starts their random weapons searches, and the Department of Environmental Quality holds their final coal ash meeting in Belmont. Our roundtable of reporters is ready. They're on the edges of their seat to detail those stories and others as well. And those reporters include David Borax from WFAE News. Welcome.
Hello, Mike.
Hi. Glenn Birkins joins us from QCityMetro.com, where he is editor and publisher there. Welcome to you.
Falling off the edge of my seat.
I know. I noticed. And there's only one seat for all of them. Ann Doss Helms joins us from the Charlotte Observer, where she is education reporter. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Eric Spanberg is back, managing editor with the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
We're all in the studio. You can watch us on Facebook Live as well. That's the back of Eric's head you're seeing. Charlotte City Council traveled to Raleigh this week for their annual retreat. Why is holding a meeting in Raleigh preferable to staying here in our fair city?
Well, the council policy has generally been that they stay home 1 year and travel the next year. And Raleigh became an option 2 years ago when they wanted to forge a better relationship with the state legislature. And so when Jennifer Roberts was mayor at that time, they had the governor come by and they had a dinner with the delegation. They did the same thing this time, obviously with a different mayor, Vi Lyles. So Governor Cooper stopped by and they had dinner with the delegation. But the main event, of course, was the 3 days of policy discussions about the budget and affordable housing and other matters.
So your paper, the Business Journal, reported that a glowing assessment of Charlotte's budget forecast took a sharp turn on Tuesday afternoon. What happened?
Well, it was interesting because the budget director started talking about surpluses, forecast of additional surpluses, being able to give raises in the next budget with minimal pain. All those things sounded really good to the reporters, to everyone in the room. And then, oh, by the way, you remember that hiccup with the Cross Charlotte Trail a couple weeks ago when it was disclosed that they were $77 million short on a project that was projected to cost $38 million. Well, there are more out there from these recent bond packages. And what the city manager, Marcus Jones, said is, we're trying to figure out exactly what the tally is.
Yeah, he said there's a long list of capital projects being reassessed. And he put the blame on past administrations for using faulty budgeting and bad project management.
We have these types of projects that started off with concepts and not necessarily any kind of preliminary design. My goal is to put it all out there and we will deal with what we have.
How bad is the prognosis?
Well, that's what we were all asking, and we don't know how bad it is. Tark Bakari, I'm not sure if you have this cut as well. That's probably a good segue right there to hear Tark Bakari's answer on that question.
All right, well, let's hear it then.
There's two big flaws here. One is that the work was never done up front, but the other is that years went by when people knew this.
So of projects that have come into being from the past and have reached completion, how many of them suffered from similar bad planning? How many of them did they have to go back to and get more money to complete?
Apparently, from my understanding, there aren't a lot that have been completed that were problematic. The challenge, to use a delicate word, is what's still out there, what hasn't been built. And you know how this works, Mike, is you approve items in a bond package, and then it takes several years to build them all out.
Right.
Well, so 2014, 16, 18, and yet another one to come in 2020, those projects are not all completed. So the ones that have not been built are ones that could be problematic.
Ann?
Well, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools used to get a lot of questions about school bond projects, and they actually have a Citizens Bond Oversight Committee that reviews the projects, and it's designed to give some accountability and some credibility to when they come to the taxpayers and the voters and say, we want to do these 10 schools, that the numbers are real. It makes you wonder if the city needs something like that.
Well, I was going to say, Mike, one of the things that was really just stunning to me is, so there, you know, it's a PowerPoint presentation, and there is a graphic that shows when council, after council approves a project that goes into these bond packages, that's when they then start to do the engineering costs and really start fine-tuning the estimates.
We talked about that. We'll come back to that in a second because David
Well, that's what I was going to say. The issue here is really asking voters to approve bonds that have bad estimates. And the process here is that you got to come up with a good estimate for what this project is going to cost and then put it on the ballot. And as Eric just suggested, it sounds like the process was done out of order there. And this goes back to the administration of former city manager Kurt Walton, and then not sure how much of it may have happened under Ron Carley, the last manager before Marcus Jones. But, you know, we need better estimates, it appears. And, you know, we talked about the $77 million shortfall on the Cross Charlotte Trail. There was another, the Communications Center, I think, was a $20 million error or shortfall
back
that we
up,
had.
Back up for a second, because Ron Carley's exit, and he was on the show several times during his tenure, Ron Carley's exit was sudden and pretty much without explanation. And yet we've known, people in the city have known about some of these problems for years. Could that have been the unmentioned problem that, that led to his departure?
Well, you never know, but I think there were a lot of other underlying tensions that led to his contract not being renewed. But I don't have the answer to that. The other thing I should say is I at least have not spoken to former manager Kurt Walton, so I don't know what the explanation is for when this originated. But clearly, from what was presented and what was said, there was a big problem with the way these things were estimated
for a long time. So we do a lot. This is the kind of story that gives government a bad name. We do a lot of things when it comes to budgeting backwards. The schools have to come up with their budget for the year, and then they go and ask for the money, and sometimes they get it. Most of the times they don't get what they want. In this situation, we put out these pie-in-the-sky projects. We say it's going to cost X amount of dollars. We take it to city council. They say, well, that's a good idea. Let's do it. And then they figure out the engineering and the specs on what it would actually cost to do it after the money's been approved.
Well, and part of this...
came up with that.
Part of this, I mean, you can't know everything and there are going to be variances. I think that is...
Yeah, but you could start at the beginning.
Right. No, I'm not arguing with you, but I'm just saying, you know, it would be reasonable that it's not going to turn out to the penny. But this is so far off from to the penny. When you're talking about $38 million and then needing $77 million. I mean, this is just not even close.
Yeah,
and I could also see that if you have 100 projects that you're thinking about and you're going to narrow it to 20, you don't do full engineering on the 100. But it does seem like there needs to be a more rational process. Okay, these are our top 30. We're going to do a lot more work before we take it to the voters.
And call me naive, but I was shocked when I read that. I was shocked that so little of the upfront work was done when they put price tags on things. I just assumed that that a certain amount of that legwork had been done to give a reasonable estimate.
So how many there's somebody on council was talking about how we went through this period where a lot of things looked really good to lawmakers, to councilmen, and that, well, let's do that. They'll make Charlotte a better place to
live.
That
was Tark Bakari was saying that, yes.
Okay, so we went through this with the banks, and we went through this with homeowners in the before the Great Recession. Everything was great. Let's try this. And there was no money to pay for any of it. Is that part of this euphoria that we went through?
Well, what's interesting is, Mike, this is post-recession that this happened. This started in 2012. This was Kurt Walton was the city manager, and it was a series of big ideas that was presented, and then it was kicked down the road by a year over a streetcar fight, and then in 13 this was approved, and that's where we are now.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Eric, you were at the meeting, but I don't think anybody's pointing fingers at Walton or Ron Carley about this as far as wrongdoing, but the process that they were using is what's being called into question, and now Marcus Jones has put a new planning process into place, and it seems to be getting good grades.
That's exactly right. That's a very good summary of where we are, and yeah, there wasn't a lot of finger pointing. I guess it was subtle finger pointing. And Marcus Jones had hinted at this before, that he had found things that he thought needed to be reconfigured. And so this was the most stark admission of what they found.
And the city council at the time, I think, has to eat some of the blame for this, because the board is supposed to oversee its employees. And I think the tendency of all boards is to just kind of, if you have a charismatic, dynamic executive telling you, here's what we're doing, here's what the cost, you don't ask too many questions. And this is why elected officials need to ask questions.
But are there not best practices for things like this?
Absolutely. And to go to your point, Ann, you better believe that if everything was coming in under budget, I think a lot of council members over the years would have been saying, hey, see, look, we've got this thing figured out.
So one of the reasons they met in Raleigh was to begin their budget process. How will what we've just talked about inform that process?
Well, that's going to be very interesting because, as I said, the operating budget, what runs the city day to day, looks to be in pretty good shape. What they have to figure out is how to manage all these things that are in the other bucket. And I think that the way they will end up managing that is things are going to be delayed because projects are going to cost more.
And so remember last year at this time, the city manager asked for, and we ended up approving, a 1 cent increase in the taxes in Charlotte. And that paid for, among other things, raises for fire and police officers, which at the time seemed like a good way to spend a little extra money. What we're hearing right now is that Marcus Jones probably will not be asking for a tax increase in this budget. It's a little fuzzy because we're going through, we've just had this revaluation, and so the tax rate is going to be reset when they do the budget. But the question is, you know, will people be asked to pay any more, or will it stay the way it is?
Well, Marcus Jones actually said no new tax increase will be needed to pay for current levels of service. The city has a $5.5 million surplus for 2018, and he's predicting a $7 million surplus for 2019, which I think ends
June 30th.
June.
Right.
Yeah, so that means they can afford, the city can afford, if they choose to keep the tax rate revenue neutral.
And it sounded like that is the direction they're leaning in. There was applause in the room when the budget director put up the graphic that said you can maintain services at the current level of taxes. But again, Mike, you have this other bucket. These are things that voters went to the ballot and approved, or went to the polls and approved on their ballots. People are going to be frustrated. I mean, we already saw with the Cross Charlotte Trail, people were pretty upset that they were paying for a project that all of a sudden is underfunded.
So one of the other things they talked about is affordable housing. Of course, in November, the voters said yes to $50 million in bonds for affordable housing. The corporate community stepped up and they put up $70 million. The Foundation for the Carolinas is trying to raise an additional $50 million. This is more affordable housing money than the city has ever had at its disposal. And one of the things that we're going to talk about is, how are we going to spend this? Did any substantive ideas emerge? And how well budgeted are they?
Well, this was one of the most surreal portions of the entire retreat because there is this private, this nonprofit entity from New York called LISC that was hired and is being partially funded by city government to help them with strategy. And then all of a sudden, they spent an hour fighting about whether or not they wanted to hand responsibility to LISC. Now, responsibility would still lie with the council in terms of ultimately approving how their money is spent, but there was a lot of unease about, well, should we be going in this direction? Ultimately, they've decided to support what they had already supported. This sounds like a government meeting. And so that's where we are for the moment.
I think a lot of that pushback might have come from pushback from the public. I know that there have been meetings out there and with members of city council, people who are in the community who are not exactly happy with the level of transparency. So some of that pushback might have come from that.
Well, and with all of this extra money comes a need for a new process. And at least one council member, Braxton Winston, has said he thinks it's time for a new process. But you've got the city money, which is more than we've had. You've got the private sector money and this local initiative support corporation out of New York, which is coming in to help advise the community. And when I say the community, I mean the private and public sectors here. They're bringing another $25 million for programs around this that are supposed to help. And it's clearly got to work differently. Now, the city process probably won't be that different. A lot of the projects that come through the city council rely on federal and state tax credits, and they will continue to look at those projects and approve those to put up for those, and the process will not change that much.
It's Charlotte Talks. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Borax is here. He was the last voice you heard.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
You're welcome. For the break.
You were saying?
Oh, I'm done.
Glenn Perkins is here from Q City Metro, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Before we move on to other news, one more thing about the City Council. One of the things I think they might have talked about, I don't know if they did or not, was the prospect of their serving four-year terms. It seems to me they were just all put into office last week, and now they've got to start running again. Is that an argument? Because the race begins now.
Yes, that is.
Is that an argument for four-year terms?
They are making that argument. Those who support four-year terms say that they, in essence, have 15-month terms because they've got to start running again. And Monday night, here's a little preview for you, Mike. I know you like to talk about things that are yet to come.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on Monday night, they'll be discussing four-year terms at City Council in greater detail. So we will no doubt get to talk about that next Friday.
Carry it live.
Yes. Right here on WFAE 90.7.
All right. Council also considered their legislative agenda for the coming year, and they heard from Wells Fargo economist Mark Vittner, he of the new logo, who gave justification for Mayor Vial Lyle's push to bring the 2020 Republican National Convention to Charlotte. What did he tell council?
Yeah, this was very interesting, and I think just from our pre-show chat, we'll get some reaction. Mark Vittner was asserting that by landing the Republican National Convention in 2020, that in essence erased the stigma of HB2 from Charlotte and North Carolina, that took away a lot of the taint and sting from the backlash and the boycotts.
Because we're inviting Republicans from all over the country to come here, is that why?
Because you have a national event, high-profile event that is coming in and signaling
landed
to others
a big one.
That it's time to come back to North Carolina.
But Republicans liked HB2. So if we'd invited Democrats in, that would be something that would agree with him there.
I get to use the reporter's cop-out, which is I'm only conveying what was said.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't he go a little bit farther than just saying that it erased the stigma? Didn't to some degree he attributed Honeywell's coming
yes.
here?
Right.
He said it was an economic development.
Yeah, he said that it really opened the door for companies to come back and was – clearly pointing to, he mentioned Honeywell and there were the other announcements in December. So he said it was a real rebound moment for the city.
And Mark Vittner is not the only one saying this right now. I mean, anybody
right.
who's involved in recruiting is yeah. saying, we're over the hump, we're past this. And
but did anyone?
And it's not entirely wishful thinking. We did
Jeff
have
Bezos
a December that was unprecedented for yeah. economic development announcements.
But can anyone explain why South Carolina is constantly cleaning our clock and they've never had a political convention?
Taxes.
Well, that's my point. There's a lot more that goes into it then.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Roads. The general
incentives. Sorry.
Yeah. The General Assembly is back in session. Oh, good news all around. Their most important job in this session is to pass a state government spending plan, which would take us through mid-2021. Has the debate on that started yet?
Yes, everybody's throwing out different proposals. We're just starting to see them, but there's a lot of talk about, will they sign on to Medicaid expansion finally? There is a state share that has to be paid. Most of the money comes from the federal government. We're talking anywhere from 339,000 people to 500,000 people who don't have insurance now who could get it through Medicaid expansion. A lot of talk about what teachers are going to get.
Democrats have long favored that, and it stems from the Affordable Care Act. And Governor McCrory at the time said we can't expand Medicaid because it's so broken we have to fix it first. Now, that was how many years ago?
Yeah, probably about five.
North Carolina was one of 14 states that have opted not to expand it under the Affordable Care Act. 37 others plus D.C. have done it. The map, if you look at it, it's mostly in the Southeast and a couple of other states that have not done this yet.
So have they fixed it? Have they fixed the problems that prevented them from joining with the Affordable Care
Act? Well, what you're hearing from the Republican side of the legislature leadership, I would say more from Tim Moore, less from Phil Berger, is that there are ways that it could be modified to make it a better fit for North Carolina. It is interesting, though, that now there seems to be a little more receptivity toward this, and a lot of it is attributed to the struggles of working poor to pay for health care.
There's really three options. One is we expand Medicaid as it was outlined under the ACA, which brings some federal money in, at least at the beginning. Another option would be to not do it at all. And another option would be what you're talking about, which is to modify it somehow. And there does seem to be a little traction on that right now. Senate Leader Phil Berger says he's against it. But as you say, maybe on the House side, there's a different sentiment.
Part of what's changed is just the national politics of it. Because when the Affordable Care Act was passed, it was Obamacare. And so everything that you were mad about health care, was supposed to be put on Obama. So that was people who were mad that they did not get Medicare or Medicaid were mad at Obama. So now that he's kind of off the scene, now it's we've all got to own this.
Be careful what you believe. The House and the governor backed nearly a $2 billion bond package for statewide school construction. The Senate is debt averse, so they may not like this package. Are they talking about that? What are they talking about that? What are they saying about that?
The school construction seems to be popular. It's sort of how they're going to do it. There are two Republican plans. There's the bond, and then there's the just work it into the budget over the next 10 years. So there seems to be a lot of enthusiasm for doing it. Locally, there's a question about how do they distribute it. Sometimes they'll distribute it by overall county wealth. So we could have a lot of, you know, hooray, tons of money for North Carolina schools, but not much of it goes to Wake or Charlotte.
And school safety is an issue, but Republicans don't like any of the gun restrictions proposed by Democrats. What were they proposing? No guns on campus?
I am not that familiar with the school safety legislative proposals.
And teacher pay raises are being debated. Again?
Again.
Let's do it?
They did, and that there's a feeling that they still need to go higher overall, and also that they need to look at how it's structured. There's a fair amount of money that's going into bonuses that are based on test scores, and a lot of teachers feel like that's not a good use of that money. There's also the experienced teachers have not gotten a lot out of these last several raises, so they're very frustrated by people having heard 6%, 7%, but they're getting 1% or 0%.
So in November, the voters eliminated the Republican supermajority in the legislature by bringing lots of Democrats into office. How will that impact what happens in this session and the tenor of this session? Will we see more compromise, or at least allowing greater Democratic participation in some decisions being made up there?
Well, that's an interesting conversation. There is certainly a school of thought that because you don't have the veto override that they will have to compromise more, that they will at least have to listen to Governor Cooper's budget proposals rather than just throwing them instantly in the trash. But there's another school I heard from some legislators saying, look, all the moderates in terms of Republicans, suburban Republicans, they're all out. So now you have more polar opposites than you had before. And maybe it'll be more strained than it was previously, which is hard to believe. So that's an answer that we don't know, Mike.
And what that will mean is that nothing gets done. And that's the other fear here.
Yes.
Okay. So we all know the continuing story of the old elections board refusing to certify the winner of the 9th congressional district race, and then a court threw out the old board because of its illegal structure, to use their words. This was to be the week when a new board was appointed, and it almost didn't happen because evidently two of the Democrats that the governor wanted on the board had been accused of electioneering. What exactly is electioneering?
Means any kind of working for a candidate, any kind of political involvement during the campaign. And it's the last 48 months is what the law says. And
so they found out that had been the case. It had also been the case with two of the Republicans that were nominated. So they had to bring four new people into the mix. But they did it, right? It's done.
An elections board. We should have a parade or something. This is exciting.
And they had a five-minute meeting so far to choose their leaders. The leader is Dan Cordle from Charlotte.
They did it on the phone.
Did it on the phone, that's right.
Yeah. So that means that we
Bob
have...
Bob Cordle. Let me correct myself
there.
Bob Cordle.
So that means that we have a board, and their first order of business is to resolve this dispute in the...
Look what you've won.
District, yes. Congratulations. Here's a balloon.
Come on down.
The staff, during all of this, has been continuing its investigation. So they're going to inherit a lot of material to go through about voter fraud in Bladen County. And they are going to hold a meeting later
in
this
February.
Month.
In February. We don't know when, but in February, yes.
But it's February now. It just started.
Perpetually yet-to-be-scheduled meeting is still yet to be scheduled.
Okay. Yes. So they will either certify Republican Mark Harris, who's leading Dan McCready by 905 votes, or order a new election, or they will deadlock, which it seems unlikely because it's three Democrats and two Republicans.
No, because remember, now you have to have four votes to order a new election, and you have to have three to certify. And when you have a 3-2 partisan split, bringing someone over, or I guess you would bring someone over from the other side in each scenario, could be complicated.
So this is supposed to be evidence-based, though, right?
Correct.
And there will be reams of evidence.
Yes.
About this, won't that be enough to convince somebody of something, or could it be shady or murky?
We can only hope that it is enough to convince someone to do the right thing. So five someone to do the right
thing. And if it's not enough to convince someone to do the right thing, then we've got the Congress as a backstop, and that's still out there.
When might we get a resolution to this saga?
Oh, I think 2024, something like that.
I mean, Bob Cordell says that he expects them to schedule a meeting in February and probably vote the same day. You know, a lot of this information about what's happened has already come out, and the question is, will the majority on the board, who are Democrats, you know, take a look at this information about improprieties and decide we need a new election? As you say, they need one more vote. Will that be there? It may drag on.
It could very easily end up in a deadlock, Mike. And then, as Glenn says, that's when things get really interesting, because then Congress becomes the arbiter. And I'm sure politics won't get involved in that at all.
And it would be the House that gets involved. And the House is controlled by the Democrats.
And they have said they're not going to seat Mark Harris right now.
And remember, the Republican argument now has shifted to, look, the legal vote total is still in favor of Mark Harris, so he should be seated. You can investigate all you want, but let's go ahead and get a representative for the 9th District.
So shenanigans, and we've talked a little bit about this before, shenanigans in Bladen County and elsewhere down there have been going on for years, and they have been reported to federal authorities who never took the time to investigate this. So if this new elections board refuses to certify Mark Harris or calls for a new election because of what they've uncovered in the course of their investigation, will that force federal prosecutors to look into this?
Well, I think that no matter what they do, Congress is going to – you're already hearing some rumblings from Congress that they're going to force this issue. So I think it's going to come out one way or another, regardless of what the elections board does.
Okay. Well, the election in the 9th District still is undecided, but election season for 2020 is underway. And while incumbent Republican Tom Tillis is gearing up, so is his field of Democratic opponents. Three Democrats, maybe four, have announced so far. Who are they?
So we have Trevor Fuller, who, of course, is a Mecklenburg County Commissioner. We have State Senator Erica Smith, and we have a Raleigh attorney named Ava Lee.
Ava Lee.
Then we get into the speculation game. That's where the real fun starts.
Because you need, it would seem to me, to be a candidate in any state for the United States Senate, you need statewide name recognition.
Absolutely.
Do any of the three that you just mentioned have it?
No, I don't think so. Now, maybe they can find a way to go out and get that recognition. But when you talk to national Democrats, consultants, they want that bigger name that you're talking about. Former Mayor Anthony Fox, who, of course, was in the Obama administration, has been mentioned. Let's see. Attorney General Josh Stein. There have been mention of Deborah Ross, who, of course, ran against Richard Burr a couple years ago. So there are a lot of big names out there. Their willingness to run, we don't know yet.
Is that wishful thinking on the part of a lot of Democrats, or are they actually considering jumping into this race at this stage?
I think with North Carolina being such a purple state, I think that people will take a long look at that. And remember, the great thing about the Senate is six-year terms. I think that's very attractive to a lot of politicians.
And the other thing, this is going to be an election year, and it's going to be a huge election year. And that tends to favor Democrats when you get large turnouts in presidential races. So how long are those coattails going to be, those Democratic coattails?
Yeah. Paul Shoemaker, who's the lead consultant to Tillis, and GOP Senator Richard Burr, says that the U.S. Senate elections are national elections. This will be a Tier 1 state, meaning it is very much a swing state. So does that mean, is he saying that the outcome of the U.S. Senate race, the Tom Tillis race, is going to be determined by the popularity of Donald Trump?
I think he's saying that in part, because obviously presidential coattails have such a big impact in these races. And remember, in 2014, which was obviously not a presidential year, you had $124 million spent in the North Carolina race. That at the time was the most expensive U.S. Senate race in history. So I think you put all those things together. This is high-stakes poker, and you're going to have a lot of interested people.
So I would compare this more to the governor's race. It is a statewide race, and Tillis himself has, I think, been very careful to not look like he's going either way on Donald Trump. I think sometimes he speaks out against him. I would go back to that Governor Cooper race that he won with support from people in parts of the state that felt that they had been wronged by the Republicans. And, you know, toll lanes comes up. Tillis is sometimes blamed for the toll lanes on I-77. Question is whether there'll be that kind of a movement this time.
So today, let me just tear the calendar page off. It's February 1st, Eric. Just wanted to point that out to you.
All right.
This time last year, Charlotte had experienced 6 homicides. This year, the number stands at 11. And according to CMPD Lieutenant Brad Koch, all these killings had one thing in common.
Every single one of these homicides this year has been at the result of gunfire. And that is certainly no way to solve or come to any sort of resolution, because once you fire that gun, you're responsible for whatever results happen from that.
So CMPD says, Glenn, it's time to de-escalate. Okay, how?
That number, by the way, that number is now at 12. The day after the lieutenant spoke, there was an infant death that was ruled a homicide. I think the child's mother was charged in that case. How to de-escalate? That's a good question. Guns seem to be a permanent part of how we settle disputes now. Just the other day, just across the street from where we're sitting, there was a non-fatal shooting at UNC Charlotte outside. Someone ended up being hit non-fatally. But in Charlotte and around the country, more and more people are just picking up guns to settle disputes.
So I wouldn't want to be in that process, because I don't see how you fix this.
Well, there's no rhyme or reason to it. When you look at where the shootings are happening, when you look at the reasons behind the shooting, there's just no easy fix. There's no one area. It's not all gun gang related. It's not all domestic related. So CMPD has its work cut out for it, trying to figure out how to address this
issue.
Well,
and that soundbite you just played, without saying it, certainly hinted strongly at the problem of the proliferation of guns, which plenty of police departments have talked about over and over. And we know that politically in the United States, it's just a non-starter, reducing gun access to any significant degree.
Well, guns are part of the problem. There's no question about the availability of guns and the escalation of the kind of guns people can get is part of the problem. But the other part of the problem is people don't seem to have any other means to resolve conflict. That seems to be their first go-to mechanism and the only one they ever consider now.
Exactly. And how do you solve that? How do you address that?
Which talks to a much deeper problem.
Absolutely.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more. We'll talk about weapons searches at CMS, which started this week, and get an update on the situation out at Bennett College. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Your idea could be the next great podcast. WFAE has launched the Queen City Podquest, a contest to find a new story for the next big show. All ideas are welcome. Submit yours by January 27th at WFAE.org/Queen City Podquest.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. It's the local news roundup. I'm Mike Collins with Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, and David Borax from WFAE News. We were just talking about guns and the police department's call for de-escalation in terms of the use of guns, and, of course, society's gun problem extends into the schools. Guns have been showing up at CMS for years, and last year one was discharged at Butler High School, which led to the death of a student after the Parkland shooting. Demand for something to be done began to be heard everywhere in the country, at least about schools, and it's been rising. And this week, the CMS superintendent instituted a new policy, one that Clayton Wilcox was reluctant to do, he says, but because we live in a new reality, this week the system began randomly checking for guns.
This is, in many ways, kind of a gross indignity that we are subjecting them to. But the young people understood.
That's Clayton Wilcox. When I wrote this, they had checked out two schools. I understood they had checked out two of the eight schools. Now you're telling me, Ann, they have checked them all.
They have done the eight, and this week started with reporters being summoned to a safety briefing and getting this really rather dramatic, you know, names of the 19 full-size high schools laid out on a table, and then with a minister, or I guess a staff putting them in sealed envelopes, a minister pulling the envelopes. So we now know that the eight that were pulled are Garinger, Rocky River, Harding, Mallard Creek, Independence, West Meck, Olympic, and South Meck.
So they're random. Not only are they randomly searched in terms of when they do this, the schools were randomly chosen?
Yes, and that was
a big... Is that smart?
Well, it was a big point for them because the fear was that they were going to target someone, that they were going to make a judgment either about which kinds of kids are more dangerous.
Why not do them all?
Well, they will eventually, I think. But again, this order became a big thing, and understandably so, because this, I think this is random because they did not want these optics. We have five Title I schools, which are the highest poverty, most resegregated schools. Three of them got picked. We have four majority white schools. None of them got picked. That is not the optics that CMS wanted. So there are some people who are saying this shows that they're going to target minorities. I think it probably shows
but
that.
But if they drew them out of a hat, how would that be possible?
Yeah, it's a bad draw.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, and again, if you're, I literally had somebody on social media saying that the reporters didn't go back and then watch them open the envelopes, which is true. But what they also did here is that they chose the most limited option. You know, they start off saying, we're going to screen every student as they come into school. Quickly realized that was going to have students standing outside of school for a very long time, which was a bad idea. So they said, well, we're going to try something where we not only randomly select a school, but we randomly select four classrooms within that school. Mm-hmm. And we have our little teams of searchers, and they march from to those four classrooms. That's all they did. Every school got the most limited possible search.
So what do they do? Wand them?
They do. They have
all
the students.
Of them, every student got
wanded?
Yeah,
they never leave the classroom. They, you know, somebody, they have the students actually open their bags and pull things out as needed.
I'm talking about on entrance. How does it start?
It starts by students just going to their classrooms. They're sitting in class. The bell has rung. And then some announcement comes on, and they tell the students what's going to happen. A text or whatever kind of message goes out to parents saying, look, your child's school has been selected, so don't freak out. This is just a routine screening. Mm-hmm. The good news is that during these screenings, they have not found anything terribly dangerous. I think the worst thing they found was some pepper spray.
Okay.
The bad news is they're doing the math, I think, that we've been doing on the show for months now. It's taking at a minimum, I think, 8 minutes per classroom, half an hour to an hour to do less than 10% of the students. It's going to take all day to do a whole school. And they're still saying, I was exchanging text messages with the communications officer right before the show started, and I said, have you all just pulled off those bigger, you know, pulled those off the table? And they said, no, it'll happen. We'll do a new drawing. We aren't saying exactly when.
So when they go into a classroom, how many officers and what are they doing?
I don't know the exact number. It's a mix of there's always at least a certified police officer in case they find something and have to deal with that. There's some school staff. They're what they call their security associates. And they're being very careful to be as non-intrusive to the students as possible. They're not frisking the students. They're doing a no-touch, kind of like when you go into the government center or a game and you hold out your arms and they wand you. I guess if they find something, they say, you know, show us what it is, pull your keys out of your pocket or whatever.
Are they using those weapon-sniffing dogs, if that's the right term?
They had said they were going to get those dogs from other police departments. Now they say they're in the process of actually buying one of those dogs for Charlotte-Mecklenburg
schools. And this is CMS police doing this, not CMPD, right?
Correct.
Ann talked about the poor optics of doing this in Title I schools. I think it's worth pointing out that while guns in school certainly is not a racial issue, when we think about the worst school shootings, they have not been in Title I schools. So this is definitely not something that should just be done in poor communities.
Well, and I think the mass shootings are actually something entirely. This is not going to prevent a mass shooting. There are a lot of other things that are doing that are trying to prevent a mass shooting. But this is, you know, a student bringing a gun. And some people think that that corresponds to demographics, and it doesn't generally.
So that's a fascinating point. I mean, people should not get the idea here that this is going to make everything safe. To me, it looks like it's more of a we got to do this for the TV cameras kind of thing. Right.
So
well, for the public.
You just mentioned the eight schools they pulled out of a hat. Wouldn't it be smart of them to do a school, random search a school that's not on the list?
Well, the schools don't know in advance, do
right.
they?
I mean, you don't know until
even,
they...
Even so, you know you're not on the list if you're at certain schools. Wouldn't it be smart?
No, they didn't release the list. They didn't.
You just gave me the names.
Well, now it's
done. Only after it's done.
Oh,
they're all done. So what is going to happen is they're going to pick another batch. And they have said, they've been careful to say, just because South Met got searched today doesn't mean they're not going to be pulled first on the next drawing and they get searched again.
Okay. All right.
It's also, I assume, and part of the argument or the basis from the school system that by having these random spot checks, that will discourage people. You know, people will be more fearful that they could be caught. That's obviously part of what they're trying to do.
They have said two goals, and one is to deter weapons, and the other is to disrupt learning as little as possible.
So how do they choose the classrooms once they're in the school?
They have said it's random. I don't know if they literally, you know, have a bunch of teachers' names in a bucket or how they're selecting that.
So they just do it over the course of, what, an hour? And then it's gone?
Taking anywhere from about 35 minutes to an hour, and part of that time is the more scattered the campus, the more time they spend, because they don't bring the students to one location, as they will do when they do a whole school search.
Okay.
They are walking from one building to the next.
So
sometimes.
How often are they going to be doing this, drawing names out of a hat and then doing the searches?
That's a good question, and Tracy Russ said they had not determined when they'd do their next drawing. This week it was two schools per day for 4 days in a row. I don't think they're going to probably keep up that pace.
Last week, Glenn, we talked about how February 1st, which is today, is the deadline for Bennett College in Greensboro to meet a $5 million fundraising goal in order to restore their accreditation. This is one of the last two remaining girls-only historical black colleges in operation. I have a figure here. Well, you have the figure, don't you?
Well, yes. As of this morning, right before we went on the air, they were at $3.6 million.
And they need five.
So they're still $1.4 million off. They still have today, and I would imagine if money came in over the weekend, they would accept it. At some point, they're going to be up against a hard deadline because the accrediting agency has to come in and audit those numbers. They have scheduled, or they are going to schedule, a Monday press conference to give the results. I guess we'll know at that time whether they hit that number, and if they don't, what the implications might be.
Again, this potential loss of accreditation, I guess they've already lost it until they come up with the money.
That's correct.
It's all money-based. It's not academic-based.
It's not academic-based.
So why does money play a role in whether or not you're accredited?
Well, I'm not an expert on this, but the short answer is financial stability. They want to be sure that these schools have some degree of financial stability.
And actually, these accreditation processes are looking at all aspects of the institution. They do go in and look at academic programs, and they take an accreditation review takes a year, and it's a huge expense and a huge time suck for people who work there. There's some question within the industry. I'm married to a college professor, so there's some question in the industry whether this actually achieves what it's supposed to achieve. Now, in the case of colleges that are financially strapped like this, I think there is something there. But in Bennett's case, you know, what the accreditation is it's a seal of approval, and among other things, it allows students at that school to get federally backed student loans, and that's really important for schools like this one. The backup plan for Bennett is to maybe get accreditation from another organization that would fill the same bill. They're a Christian school, and there's a Christian accreditation organization that they are looking at as a backup. It's not clear to me if that can happen in time to satisfy
their needs.
Well,
I think
needs.
The president has also said they'll sue if they don't get their accreditation. So they have a plan B and a plan C.
So Bennett is just the latest of these historically black colleges and universities to suffer monetary difficulties. And we talked a little bit last week, Glenn, about how a lot of that's due to the fact that there are more options for African-American students than there were when these colleges were established. There were no options when these colleges were established. What do you see as the future of HBCUs, given that reality?
Well, I think at some point there's going to have to be consolidation or retrenchment. There are dozens. We were talking before we went on the air. There are just dozens of HBCUs. And while they all serve a purpose, I'm not sure in this changing environment that they can all be successfully supported financially. So, but the problem is no one wants to give up his or her alma mater.
Right.
If you went to a certain school, you want that school to be around. You don't want to sacrifice your school for the greater good.
And interestingly enough, a lot of alumni have donated, plus this major sorority has donated an enormous amount of money to keep them afloat.
Money continues to trickle in. I was talking with someone there in their administration earlier this week, and she painted a picture of individuals, church groups, church organizations, civic organizations walking in with checks for $1,000 here or $500 here. Mm-hmm. Money is coming in, but it's a tall order to raise $5 million in such a short period.
Meanwhile, UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor Carol Folt departed this week. She resigned earlier this month, then ordered the removal of the Silent Sam pedestal. Silent Sam had been gone by then, and that was followed by the board prematurely ending her tenure. So she ended her tenure yesterday. What does her departure and that of System President Margaret Spellings mean for that campus and for the university at large? Is the university system simply becoming a political football?
Well, that's certainly a question that's out there. The Board of Trustees seems to be really wanting to shape it in their image, and that image is a fairly political one.
Hmm. Is that the function of a state university, to be a political arm?
Well, in fact, that you want the freedom, the academic freedom, but although I guess conservatives would say that if that tends to be liberal, then that's political in its own way.
All right. Meanwhile, Duke University got some unwanted publicity when a professor's email asking Chinese students not to speak Chinese in the buildings that house the Department of Biostatistics, that email went public. So why did Megan Neely, the director of graduate studies in biostatistics, feel compelled to write that email in the 21st century?
Who knows?
Where this stuff goes viral.
Yeah.
Who knows what was going through her mind there.
Do you have a college degree?
a couple of other faculty members complained about it, sent her emails complaining about it, and in her role as the head of the graduate program in the Department of Biostatistics, she felt she had to respond.
So her
to
answer was, they told me to.
So is this an isolated incident, or is this emblematic of a deeper problem at Duke?
Well, I think the problem, I mean, they didn't just complain. They didn't just say, I took offense at this. They asked to come in and look at photos and identify which students these were so they could deny them opportunities.
Ah.
And the dean said, okay. And that all happened.
Deeper problems.
And then
Duke.
The dean sent out a message and said, look, you don't want to end up in this situation, so... To me, that's the shocking part, is that the dean did not say no, and in fact, you're in trouble for making this request.
I mean, this is so clear-cut to me. I studied Chinese in Taipei. I can't imagine somebody ordering me to speak Chinese with my American friends. I couldn't imagine it.
Mm. All right, more than 200 people came to a public meeting in Gaston County this week on Tuesday night to talk to state environmental officials about coal ash at the Allen Steam Station on Lake Wylie. And David, you were there. How did this meeting compare to the impromptu town hall that happened, up in Catawba or Iredell
County?
That's
right. Near the Marshall Steam Station on Lake Norman a couple weeks ago, they had a meeting and people basically hijacked it and demanded to be heard.
Right.
At this meeting, they actually changed the format and they did have microphones available for folks to speak. And like the meeting up around the Marshall plant, people were overwhelmingly against the idea of leaving the ash where it is. They want Duke to dig it up.
Yeah, 8 of Duke Energy's current and former coal-fired plants are required by law to excavate ash and move it to new landfills. And Amy Brown, one of the citizens at that meeting, criticized the plan.
I want to know how this department, this administration, this governor will ever be able to justify cleaning up 8 and leaving 6. You can't. You can't justify that.
You reported that people cheered for her after she made that statement. So did officials try to justify it?
Well, they were there to listen, not really to give a response. I did talk to the Deputy Secretary of Environmental Quality there, and she said all the options are still on the table. It was interesting to me that this campaign by people who oppose Duke's plans is getting more political, and they are pointing fingers at the governor who, during his campaign, constantly attacked former Governor McCrory about his ties to Duke Energy and the failure of Duke to the state to order Duke to do the cleanups.
So very quickly before we run out of time here, last weekend, a week after the women's marches in other parts of the country took place, Charlotte held its third such march, the Women United March, and organizers in advance stressed that this was not supposed to be partisan. Was it? Were they successful in that?
I think mostly they were. There were signs, of course, that were political. There were a few Trump images. It was much less Trump-focused. It was actually much less March-focused, and it was a smaller crowd than previous years. but it was very much focused on the speakers, and they ranged from the traditional equal pay for equal work, reproductive rights, to a number of issues that were much really challenging the people who were there, saying you have not done enough for all the communities that are disenfranchised.
So march sizes across the country were down from the previous 2 years. How much smaller was Charlotte's this time around?
Guesstimate would be 2,500 to 3,000 compared to that first year, more than 10,000.
So what does that tell you?
Things are evolving.
Okay. Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Berkins from QCityMetro.com, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and David Borax from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.